like giddy yeah. about our guest today.
Yes.
So officially, hello and welcome back to Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul. I'm Sarah.
I'm Paul.
That's Paul. Paul, do you want to tell them who we have on today?
Well, our guest is one of the most celebrated actors from the American stage. He has an extraordinary filmography. He has Lifetime Achievement Awards. He has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Wow. In fact, that actually, I know. You know what's funny? I've actually got a few friends with stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame now. And I'm like, I guess that makes me, no. That makes me like adjacent. I'm like the gum on the, anyway. My point is that Prison Break was such a tiny part of this phenomenal actor's career that we could, if you could take it out and he would still be a national treasure. So we have, Stacey Keach is joining us today, what we're saying, who played Warden Henry Pope himself. So let's cut to the chase, get our Callistine Index done, and get to Stacey.
Yes. cannot wait. He's not only a wonderful actor, but he is just, he should be a national treasure just personality-wise alone, let alone his extraordinary talent and career.
Everybody should have a Stacey Keach plush toy, just for when they're sad.
Stacey Keach plush toys, probably not easy to say. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, episode 202 was called Otis, and it aired on August 28th, 2006. It was directed by Bobby Roth, written by showrunner Matt Olmsted, and it pulled in 9.44 million viewers in the 8 p.m. slot. Those numbers seem huge. Also airing in that slot was a news special on NBC called Katrina, The Long Road Back, since this is about the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana and Texas, as well as reruns of ABC and CBS of Wife Swap and Two and a Half Men, respectively.
So, quickly to recap the episode, Pope and Bellick face discipline after the escape. After C.O. Geary's testimony, that slimy little son of a gun, Bellick is fired. Pope quits in a fit of pique. Bellick later finds pique. Actually, it's not even pique. It's just like standing up for what he believes in. Bellick later finds that the government has put a bounty on the capture of each of the Fox River Eight. The escape team goes their separate ways.
As he's putting a shotgun. He's thinking about killing himself. Yes.
Tries to kill himself. His mom from the other room saves his life. Yeah. The escape team goes their separate ways, but when Lincoln learns that LJ is going to be tried as an adult, he convinces Schofield to try and rescue his son, which is not tattooed anywhere on Michael Schofield's body, this plan. And because it's an ad hoc plan, perhaps, the plan is foiled by Mahone, who figures out the code that Link had used to give the secret instructions to LJ. And the brothers are forced to escape without LJ, who is carted off to the clink. Meanwhile, Bagwell has his hand gruesomely reattached before killing the vet. That's right, vet who did it, and stealing his car, intending to go to Utah, where Westmoreland's money is hidden. And Tweener continues pickpocketing and accepts a ride with a college girl going home, also to Utah.
In pop culture, in this week, on August 30th, the Venice Film Festival opened with a showing of Brian De Palma's The Black Dahlia. The 58th Emmy Awards were held a few days earlier on August 27th, hosted by Conan O'Brien at the Shrine in L.A. And just a few days later on August 28th, Jack Black hosted the MTV Music Video Awards at Radio City Music Hall, where Panic at the Disco won Video of the Year.
And in world events, on August 24th, the International Astronomical Union voted to demote Pluto from the ninth planet of the sun to one of the dozens of known dwarf planets. And I'm still really upset about this. My kids will tell you. I mean,
me too. Anybody of our generation's like, what?
Pet peeve. Yeah, like the things you learn grade three and lower shouldn't change. Don't tell me that like six is now not in the first 10 numbers. Don't tell me that red is no longer a color, and don't tell me that Pluto is no longer a planet. I memorized it. And now I'm breathing. Moving on, August 31st, Edvard Munch's iconic 1893 painting, The Scream, was recovered after a two-year investigation because it had been stolen.
Incredible.
Several individuals were convicted for the theft and sentenced to prison. I don't believe they were broken out. It is currently on display. at the National Museum in Oslo, Norway. Paul, could you please just do just a quick impression of the scream? Oh, well, I was reading off the thing.
Oh, that might be, it might be Home Alone.
It's, it was same. I mean,
it's kind of the same.
Like, yeah, it's, yeah. A, it's a thin, it's a thin line.
Since then, and I, this obviously didn't exist at the time, the memes of that have been become incredible. There's so many great memes using the scream.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back with Stacey motherfucking Keach.
Woo!
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Okay.
Okay, we're back.
We're back.
Okay, so Stacey's career is so impressive and massive that we just had to write it down for a written introduction. His film career goes back to the late 1960s. Heart is a Lonely Hunter. He's worked with Paul Newman, Georgie Scott, Faye Dunaway, amongst others. He was nominated for a Golden Globe for playing Ernest Hemingway. He has portrayed Wilbur Wright, Napoleon, and Oppenheimer on stage. He's played Hamlet, Falstaff, Scrooge, King Lear, Richard III, and Macbeth. Are we in a theater? No. And just the tip of an ice, that's just the tip of the iceberg that includes awards like 3 Helen Hayes Awards, a handful of Lifetime Achievement Awards, and starred in one of my favorite 70s movies, Fat City.
Okay, amazing. He's also an award-winning director. He's a super accomplished piano player. His television resume is so long that we don't have time for it, but we do have to mention that he played the title role in Mike Hammer, and that made him a familiar face to a generation of television viewers 20 years before Prison Break ever aired. Plus, he's an incredibly nice person.
Anyway, here's Stacey. Welcome.
Stacey Keach.
And I don't mind not seeing myself.
I feel the same.
We know how you feel. We know how you feel. So the whole time you were doing Prison Break, you were going back and forth to Poland.
Back and forth.
Every episode.
Every other. Well, we would do 2 episodes, and then I would have some time off, and then we'd do 2 more. I'd do the end of the first episode and the beginning of the second. But I spent a lot of time in Chicago, even in spite of it, you know, which I love Chicago. I did Arthur Miller's last play in Chicago. I did my King Lear there.
Yeah.
Because the King Lear was season 2, right? While we did season 2 in Dallas, you did Lear in Chicago.
Right. Exactly.
And, I mean, at least to us, Paul and I talked about this last week. The move to Dallas was a huge surprise to us. We all thought we were coming back to Chicago.
Yeah.
And then there was a sort of last minute pivot. Did that change? Like, were you going to be in more of season 2?
I don't know. I really don't know. At that particular point in time, things were very kind of, for me anyway, I didn't know what was going on. I mean, it was, quite frankly, I don't think anybody did quite yet. We were still in the process of trying to make decisions.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Stacey, do you remember taking the role, getting that offer and deciding to do it? You hadn't done television in a while. And then you decided to do Prison Break. I know you love Chicago, but was there other stuff about that project that made you want to do it? Is there anything particular?
Well, yes. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about. You know, I had been incarcerated myself because I was a drug addict in 1981 and 2. And I spent 6 months in Reading Jail, where Oscar Wilde spent his time. And so I got to learn the warden and his behavior. I was in deep shock because I felt that instead of being incarcerated, sent to prison, And as it turned out, it was an amazing experience for me. And I was given 9 months, but the warden at the time, Governor Hay, was an amazing man, and he had lost a son to drug addiction. So he was very sympathetic to me, and he gave me, I couldn't show favoritism, but he gave me a job as a librarian. And one of the functions of the librarian was to translate and write letters for the young offenders, for the kids that were in prison. And there was a whole wing of them. So I was very busy.
Wow.
The whole time. He was a very compassionate man. And I thought Warden Pope was a very compassionate warden.
It's one of the things that's so interesting about the character and his relationship with Michael. And of course, also Pope has a son who died. Was that already part of the story? Is that something that you brought to them?
No, it wasn't part of the story. It was something I brought. I think it was something that was definitely not manufactured, but it was. Mm-hmm. I brought it because of the experience of the warden at Reading Jail, who had lost his son when 22 years old.
And Stacey, when you said that you were, you know, you were obviously tried and incarcerated, what was it? What did they, like, what'd you get caught?
Possession of cocaine.
Okay, so you were, like, going through the airport or something?
Yeah, I was coming out of the airport.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
And those were some wild days. I mean, so after I worked with you, years later, I went on to Walking Dead. And for our second season, Frank Darabont called, I think, four of us, me, John Bernthal, Andy Lincoln, and Laurie Holden. He said, I just hired Scott Wilson. And if you don't know who he is, I'm sending you two films. I'm sending you
The Ninth Configuration.
The Ninth Configuration was one of them, but the other one was the one In Cold Blood.
Yeah.
He said, don't you dare show up to set without seeing both of these movies. This is one of the best actors alive. And I'm watching The Ninth Configuration going, holy shit, that's my buddy Stacey. And I mean, that movie is crazy. And Scott and I got really close hearing some of his stories of what it was like back then.
Well, I'm the only person still alive who made that movie.
And you were two boys from Georgia. Kind of in your prime. I mean, I can only imagine the two of you tearing up. Where did you shoot that movie?
The Ninth Configuration?
Yeah.
We shot it in Hungary, Budapest. Part of it was also shot in Northern California, financed with frozen funds from Pepsi Cola.
Wow.
Really?
Those were the days, man.
Yeah. Even when we did Prison Break, it was the beginning, just the beginning of a different platform for television series. We're just coming out of ER,
mm-hmm.
very popular.
Mm-hmm. Lost had just premiered.
I just got through playing George Clooney's father.
Oh,
really?
In our next movie together.
Oh, fun.
Which will be out in 2025.
Who directed it?
Noah Baumbach.
Oh, great.
Greta Gerwig's husband. It's a very expensive movie, too.
I would bet.
What's the title so we know to keep an eye out for it?
J. Kelly.
I'm going to take you back to Prison Break for a second. So when you...
Yes, please.
When you come and do a character like Pope, and you've had this experience with this warden, and there's a similarities, does that go into how you think about the character, obviously psychologically? Does it go into the characterization too? Like what he looks like, how he moves, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, totally. Which, that part of it is, instead of being literally, you know, I didn't want to literally imitate Brian Heyday, but it was about the essence of compassion.
Yeah.
That's it. That he really cared for his inmates, and he wanted them to be busy and involved and good to one another. This was but as far as the physicality of the character was concerned, I chose my own look and my own walk and my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was such a Sarah and I were talking about it in season one when we were watching season one. It's such a great ballast for the show that Pope is this compassionate authority figure, because obviously the whole premise of the show is prison bad, have to get out, bad things happen, it's all corrupt. Mm-hmm. He's there for the wrong, you know, he's been falsely accused, Lincoln's been falsely convicted. But then you have this kind of, I mean, Pope is, of all these people, the true believer.
Absolutely.
I mean, he really gets taken advantage of in a way.
I get sucker punched. You know, I was very, very lucky to have had that experience, and it totally justified my time in jail. Mm. It really, if I hadn't had that experience, horrible as it was, I would never have been able to play this character the way I played it, you know. And as far as the badness, that was Belling, Wade Williams.
That's right.
We become very, very good friends during that period.
Yeah.
The great thing about that era, that particular cast, the cast of that show was superb. Everybody was so right for the characters they played. And it was like ensemble theater. It was like doing a play.
Yeah, it really was.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there were certain scenes. I remember when we were watching last season, watching those scenes in the execution chamber, where there were sort of six people inside, and then there was an actual proscenium and the audience and the people watching. And it feels like a play all of a sudden. And I remember the energy in that room.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, for me, I was at the very beginning of my career. I mean, we shot that stuff in 2005. I got out of grad school in 2002. I was just learning. And all I'd ever done is theater. And so you were a big part of learning to translate one skill set into another
one. Thank you. I appreciate that. Working in front of a camera has always been a very interesting experience for me. You know, over years, of course, you learn tricks and techniques that you would never even consider if you were just working in the theater.
And to me, I grew up doing theater in Chicago. Yeah. And then most of the stuff, I'd done a little film and I'd done a little TV. And the way that you're talking about, you know, things were changing in the landscape at that time. There was almost a feeling when I was started late 90s doing TV, that TV and film were different and that the tone of it was different. Obviously the process was different just because of the speed of television. But Prison Break, and this is something else we noticed and some of these other shows that started coming out then, they started to feel more like films.
Exactly.
Watching you, because I was, you know, like Fat City was one of the reasons I wanted to become an actor. I saw what you were doing on Prison Break, and I was like, oh, there's no difference between film acting and TV acting.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it was a huge hit in Poland. Mm. And the way they do television in Poland, they have one voice who reiterates all of the dialogue, male and female.
Oh my God.
Wait, so
one voice does
every
dubbing?
You hear the English too?
Every character?
You hear them both at the same time?
You hear the English underneath.
Uh-huh.
The Polish is on top.
It's amazing.
And that's how they do all their movies.
Wow.
I can't stand it.
Oh, it drives you crazy.
But it works.
Does it make it hard to follow?
Not in Poland. No.
Wow.
Oh, that's a great challenge as an actor to have to do that. That would be fascinating to do.
I thought one of the great virtues of our show, Prison Break, was the camaraderie between the actors, you know, most of the time. Mm. the bad guy actors, of course, sometimes it were difficult, but generally speaking, the togetherness and the inspiration that and the respect that each of the actors had for one another, I think, helped catapult that show to the success that it became.
I really think audiences smell that.
Absolutely.
I think they sense trust. They sense trust. I mean, was it odd for you coming in? Like, you had a career that, quite frankly, if you took Prison Break out of it, would still be illustrious career. We were all a bunch of brand new idiots.
I mean, I loved you guys. No, I loved everybody. No, it was a wonderful experience. Right from the beginning, Brett Ratner. Yeah, he generated a very, he had good vibes. He was a good director. I know a lot of actors didn't like it. I loved
it. I think he was one of those guys who...
That's really cool.
The experienced actors do their thing, and then other people he maybe wasn't so great with.
I think that's a very good accurate description of his.
You were just talking about your history informing why this was the role that you took. Do you have a sort of overall matrix or sort of guiding principle when you decide what roles?
Well, in my later years, yes. But as a young actor, no. I just took whatever came along. But in my later years, I look for more comedy. I love doing comedy. I really do. I didn't do a lot of it in my early years. I was a very serious actor. I love doing comedy. I love doing Titus, for example. And I love sitcoms. I really did.
Oh, I loved Titus so much. Mm-hmm. I loved
Two and a Half Men. Two and a Half Men. With John Amos, played my lover.
And did that feel like theater to you? Because you're doing it in front of a live front of an audience.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, totally. It's very much like theater in that respect. And but now things are changing so rapidly that even series television has taken on a whole new color that, quite frankly, I'm not crazy about, are you?
Would you say more about that, about sort of what you mean when it comes to the change in television? Because, I mean, you were there from all the way from My Camera to Prison Break to now.
I think that a lot of it has to do with economics, of course.
Of course.
And time. Mm-hmm. Time is money. And time, the time spent in television today is, it's always been fast. It's always been quick. And you've got to be there, boom. You know, you got to be ready when they turn on the switch. You got to have your stuff ready to go. One rehearses that way. You rehearse what the scene is about, memorize your lines, of course, and try doing it as many different ways as possible. Because that, to me, is the crux to really wonderful, acting. You don't repeat the same thing twice. Even though one of my favorite stories, Kurt Russell and I were doing Escape from L.A. And John Carpenter was directing, and he said, that was great. That was absolutely perfect. Let's do one more. And he said, if that was so perfect, why don't we just print that one twice?
That's it.
Do you want that kind of variation when
and
you're,
you can't
you want
do
that
it
kind
again.
Of variation when you're doing a theater run too? I mean, do you feel night to night?
Yes.
You do.
Yes, absolutely. You want to be fun. You want to be spontaneous and there at that moment. Every night. And in fact, it's wonderful when things get richer and deeper. I mean, the exercise when I was teaching acting was always, how many ways to say I love you? It's a great exercise for young actors particularly, because then they really get to see the difference between, I love you, to see those different tones and shades, which is what, to me, is the benchmark of a great actor, which is variety. It's about variety. It's about living in the moment that you are living in yourself. Unless you're doing comedy again. If you're doing comedy, it's a whole different set of circumstances.
You think there's more freedom in comedy?
I think so. I think there is. Because you, in order to make something, in order to get the laugh, you've got to, you know, you may have to try 14 different things.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Uh-huh.
What always felt like such a joy of what we do is that when you're working with a terrific actor, the audience will see one performance cut together and it'll be great. But I've seen six, because I've seen all the different choices that actor has made in that scene.
Right.
And only one of them's going to make the cut. But I got to watch them all. And that to me is part of the joy of the job, is watching up and somebody surprising you, whether it's acting or directing. Somebody, you're watching it going, oh, I would never have thought to read the line that way, which then changes everything that comes afterwards. I remember, there's no reason you would remember it, but it stuck with me. I called you, I think, a couple of weeks after you opened Lear at the Goodman in Chicago. And I was like, how's it going? My mom's a Shakespeare scholar. She actually saw it later when you moved it to DC. And loved it. But I remember calling you to ask how it was going, because Lear has a reputation of chewing actors up and spitting them out.
Yeah.
And you said something I'll never forget. You said, Sarah, the irony of Lear is that by the time you're old enough to understand him, it's really hard on your body to give the performance. And you got off the phone really quickly. You're like, I'm not talking when I'm not performing the show right now because my voice is going. And it made such an impression on me about that. And I just wondered if you wanted to speak to that at all, because there are some of these roles that you grow into.
Yeah. And again, with Lear, not just Lear, most of Shakespeare that I've done, it's never the same. It's always different. It's always, you know. I mean, the to be or not to be, that is the question, or that is the question, that is the question. You know, actors, they goof on how many different ways you can say any number of things. Again, as an exercise to not find yourself in what I call the repetitious rut, where you do what you did yesterday to same today. Bold faced honesty.
Yeah.
So you've been in the business for a while. You've been TV famous.
Watched it all through high
school. You've been movie famous. You've been celebrated for theater. You have, I discovered, walking to get groceries one day in Los Angeles, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I apologize. I stepped on you. But I backed up and apologized and said hello. How do you feel about fame?
Yeah.
It's the most elusive, and I think dangerously elusive. When you put too much emphasis on that, being famous or being well known, it can get in your way. Oh boy. And it has with me, I was never very comfortable being a star when I was a young actor. To me, it was about the work. It wasn't about fame. But then I began to see other actors get better roles because they were in a movie that made money. So suddenly I said, well, maybe fame ain't such a bad thing after all. But I'm not in charge. To me, it's not as important. Respect, right? As an actor in the theater, it was always good to get good reviews. I made a distinction between that and fame. Fame to me was more of a, I don't know, more of a, like a popularity contest, instead of judging somebody's work and the quality of their work, which has always been more important than, you know. Titus had a lot to do with that. I really loved being that guy. Being that bad guy. just as nasty as he could be. It was so much fun. So I began to equate fun with success. That was an important move for me. Because I didn't want to take myself so seriously.
I think at the beginning, especially if you're not strictly doing comedy,
right?
As some people come up, you want to be taken seriously.
Yes.
And you're young, and so I mean, in Chicago, for instance, there were two distinct. I think they're more intermingled now, but there was the comedy scene and there was the serious theater scene, and they didn't really mix.
No, they were very different. Well, Second City had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's right. And Steppenwolf. There was kind of like you were either here or here.
Yeah.
And, we were so serious as because we wanted to be taken seriously as actors. So you didn't, you wanted to enjoy work, but like saying it was fun or it was like, you needed to be a little tortured. You needed to be beating yourself up. And it takes a certain kind of, it took time to be able to say, we're just playing. We're just fucking around.
Exactly.
I mean, you're always trying to get back to that, but I'm glad that you're able to say it so plainly, because I think it's important always to have that sense of, a sense of joy, a sense of joy, even if you're doing the most serious thing in the world, that it's, it is called a play.
I mean, it is called a play.
It's called playing a scene.
For me, that was one of the things that I wanted to do with Lear. I wanted to make sure that the human didn't abandon the human. There's not a lot of it, but there is. But it's there. He gets what he gets when he's goes bonkers.
And then it's fun to do. And
that.
Then it kind
I tried
of
to get up to
lightens
Chicago for it.
The load of what you're doing.
Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about already what's changed, obviously, in the business in that time. But is there anything else, like as you look? I don't know. Forgive me for keeping coming back to this, but your perspective.
Well, I've been around a while. Huh?
Because when you think about what's changed, you talk about the speed and the pace and the money,
right,
and the way that there's been a sort of attrition of quality in television because of that. Are there other changes that you look at as?
It has a lot to do with amount. The amount of work that's available now, particularly in the theater on the road, it's almost zip. I mean, one or two plays, that's it. In the old days, we would, there'd be half a dozen at least. I think the nature of the experience of watching a play and the amount of time it takes, what an audience has to go through to buy a ticket, to stand in line, to come and see it. It's more work than it used to be. It used to be a luxury that you enjoyed. Now it's just, oh God, I don't want to have to stand at the box office and wait for my tickets. It's a totally different feeling.
Okay, so I know we got to let you go soon, but I want to ask
let's hear it.
At least my final question. Paul, if you want to follow this up, please feel free. But one of the things, a couple of years before he died, he wasn't sick yet. Scott and I were having dinner and he turned to me. We were talking about career. We were at Musso and Frank's. And he said, Sarah, I say this without ego. By the way, we were two martinis in at this point. So I just have to, they're big at Musso. So I just got to caveat that a little bit. So I think what he said, from what I remember, was I've been in about 9 films that were nominated for Academy Awards. I've worked for Tennessee Williams on stage. I've been doing this since I was 20-some years old. I am known exclusively as the old guy on The Walking Dead. And we laughed so hard. I think because someone had just come up to us in the show and he thought come to us in the restaurant and was like, "You're that guy from The Walking Dead." And he was so gracious and he was so sweet about it. But it was really fascinating to him that after this incredibly long, illustrious career that spanned theater, radio, film, television, Poland, England, Italy, the US, all over the world, he was known for this weird old zombie show. What is it that people know you for? When people come up to you?
Primarily Mike Hammer. Mike Hammer.
And is that what you want to be known for?
I don't have any control. But I mean, I when somebody says, "I love your Hamlet or your Lear or your Falstaff," that means more to me than "I loved your Mike Hammer." Even though, you know, it's cool.
Fair. Fair. The things we're known for are very often not the things we're most proud of, I find.
And we don't, and
really
it becomes, at a certain point, it becomes, what's the...
Yeah.
You have the right to the work, but not to the fruits of the work. It's like you do it, and then it goes out into the world.
Well, you know, I'm very at the tail end of my career. I'm very excited that I got to play George Clooney's dad in a very, very nice part at the end of the movie. I'm only on at the end, but it's a wonderful role. And I love working with Joe. He's the real deal. He's a superstar. And he's so nice to everybody. And he's very talented. I think he's more talented as a director than he is as an actor. But he's a great movie star. He is the real definition of a star. It's Joe.
All right, I have a question for you. And this is a question we're asking all our guests this year because of what happens in season 2 of Prison Break. Last year we asked about, you know, final meals and things like that. This year we're asking, if you had to run from the law and hide out for the rest of your life, where would you go? Where would you go? And what would you do? I picked like I'd work on a clam shack in the Caribbean somewhere. That's where I would try to disappear to.
Either Tasmania or Hobart. I'm not sure.
Oh, wow.
It's down at the bottom of Australia.
Yeah, no one's going to find you in either one. No one's going to find you in either one of those.
Okay. We just ended with a geography lesson.
It's a good question. I like that.
That's amazing.
Well, this has been great fun, you guys. I'm so happy we did this.
Well, I mean, honestly.
Yeah, so good seeing you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
You too.
It's such an honor. It's great to see you again.
And you know, this show, you know,
we had
it's
a lot
huge
of fun.
They put it out on Netflix, whatever it was, a month and a half ago. It's blown up again. It seems like every 4 years,
it's a great show. It was a big change for me. Well, it was a great, great event for me personally because I got to express all the things that I learned in prison when I was an inmate.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate it.
No.
Bye.
All right. Ciao, friend.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
What a just incredible career and human.
Yeah. And we didn't even get to how many languages he speaks because it's like, I mean, he's living in Poland. He speaks like 3 or 4.
Really?
Amazing. So thank you all for being with us. We're grateful that you were with us as well.
Yes.
So if you want to watch the watch party with us, we actually do talk about episode 2
as
we're watching the watch party. That link is, in the show notes, to the Patreon community, wherever you're listening right now. And if you want to drop any Pope fan art,
oh, cool.
in our DMs on Instagram. We'd love to see it. That's at Prison Break Podcast. And here is our call-in question for the week. Ooh. In honor of this great living stage actor. Maybe read us your favorite sonnet or poem or monologue, whatever inspires you. You know, share something from maybe the theater or poetry or something that, you know, is Stacey Keach / Henry Pope worthy.
Wow, cool.
You can leave it on our call-in line. That's 1-401-3-P-BREAK, P-B-R-E-A-K.
And we should maybe, back in the day, Lane Garrison, who we will have as a guest, yeah, does an incredible Stacey impression.
Does he?
Yes. It was Stacey playing golf, because they played a lot of golf together, but it's a great loving impression.
Amazing. Okay. Well, when we have Lane on, because I think we are having,
maybe we'll have him read a sonnet as Stacey.
Oh, yes. Yes, we absolutely will. And if you want to read a sonnet as Lane playing Stacey, please.
Whoa.
That sounds amazing.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Anyway, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Have a great week and don't get hunted. Bye.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production.
Your hosts have been inmates Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Adelstein.
Our prison warden is producer Ben Haber.
Getting us all cut up in the prison yard is editor and sound designer Jeff Schmidt.
The front man of our jailhouse rock band is yours truly, Paul Adelstein, who made all the music.
Our prison yard tattoo artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com.
Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at pbpodcast@caliber-studio.com. And call us at 401-3-P-BREAK.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening. Void where prohibited, not available in all 51 states. Why, Paul? Because there are only 50 states.
Because there's only 50 states.
But
so far,
we love a Maori, and we want Puerto Rico.
Correct.
I don't know. I just made up a political standpoint for no reason.
Well, I stand with you.
There we go.
We'll
all
see
right,
you next
bye,
week.
Everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Cheers.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.